of our week on theology of peacemaking, and rather than dividing ideas topically, we are focusing on personalities and events through which truths and ideas have come to be powerful in our time. We were talking about Tolstoy the last time as a major figure in modern Western culture, and now we move to Gandhi. My point is not to fill in information, although we need some of that, so much as to see through the story a set of ideas. As when we say theology, we mean some understanding about God or the power of God. And obviously, we have a very different basis to talk about this than we would have 2 years ago. How many people here have seen the Gandhi film? I assumed it would be most of us, if not absolutely all. We don't want to center on that film, although there may be things in it that will illustrate what we'll be talking about. And if there's anything in your response to the film that you'd want to bring into the conversation, that would be fine. Gandhi was, like Tolstoy, a bridge person between two cultures. He was very Indian and never ceased to be that. In fact, as he grew older, he became more Indian. That is, he became more aware and more proud of his Indian identity. He wrote in his mother tongue, Gujarati, which is not one of the largest, most widely represented Indian languages. He rebounded from a time when he was trying to be an Englishman. In his biography, he talks about that in rather silly details regarding how much starch to put in his shirts and other ways in which he was trying to be a dandy when he was in London to study law. He used the Hindu scriptures, especially the Bhagavad Gita, as a part of his own spiritual disciplines. And yet he was at the same time very effective in relating to the Western world in its own terms. He had a British legal education, although to hear him tell it, he never studied very hard, so that he could use the status of lawyer to get a hearing in South Africa. You remember from the film that the man in the railroad car at the beginning didn't want to believe that there was such a thing as an Indian lawyer, but his claims could stand up. He failed, actually, in India as a lawyer. He was timid in the wrong times and shrewd in the wrong times, but he was a successful practitioner of the law in South Africa, completely Anglo-Saxon cultural tool that he had learned to use against its owners. He believed in, relatively, the virtues of Anglo-Saxon common law justice. It is the idea that it makes sense to appeal to the public opinion, that it makes sense to hope that an independent judiciary may protect the rights of an individual, even against the state. The power of print, in particular, as a medium of communication, all of these were elements of the power of Anglo-Saxon culture that he used very wisely. He found a place to put his lever to pry, or a position within which to work at Western powers, especially the British Empire, with its own tools of moral discernment. That is, he appealed to Jesus, to the gospel, to other simple Western Christian moral insights against the power structures of the British Empire in the interest of, first of the Indian minority in South Africa, and then the Indian majority in his own continent. Gandhi was a convert in a way. We saw the importance last night of Tolstoy's making a radical change in his mid-adult life. When a person has made a change like that, that change itself gives them a different kind of leverage, as over against someone who has always just become happily the product of whatever his society wanted to make him. In that sense, too, Gandhi is a Westerner. That is, he changed. His person was turned around by certain experiences and insights, which he reports as such. Both conversion as a personal reorientation, where you really become somebody different because of something that's happened to you, and conversion as a new value system, which shapes a new world. That is, a new way of evaluating the things that you do and the action you're going to take on the basis of other grounds than what your youth had provided you with. He had, in fact, numerous conversions. You read his own biographical material, he says at least 5 or 6 times that that book changed his whole life. Once it was about vegetarianism, once about the place of the courts. But the turnings that made him who he was, the turnings that mattered the most, are identifiable in his own writings more deeply than those two. One was the very notion that you defend the rights of the citizen, that the citizen has rights, and that it is a part of not only selfish self-defense, and not only pride or personal dignity in the sense of pride, but it is somehow for the sake of a wider value, for everyone's sake, or for humanity's sake, or for God's sake. It is my duty to defend my rights or our rights. And that's the insight with which he came out of his night on the railroad platform at Pietermaritzburg, with which the story actually begins in the film, after the portion of the film that's really the end of it that comes first. That notion of the dignity of the person which needs to be defended against the oppressiveness of the system around the person, even if it's costly, even if it isn't possible, there is simply a moral obligation to say no to something that denies your dignity. And of course, he did that from then on. He didn't usually do it for himself. He did it for his people, whichever party of his people at a particular point called for that defense. But the notion that it is not only selfish self-defense, but that it is a contribution to the coherence of the universe, to refuse to let the rights of the downtrodden be trodden upon without objection, that's when he began to be somebody with a sense of purpose and with enormous assurance and enormous confidence. The other two conversions that he reports that are theological, that is, that have to do with ideas, are both the results of reading Western books. And he says it that way in his own biographical material. One of them, the first of them, was reading Tolstoy. So there is a continuity linking our two hours. Tolstoy's book, The Kingdom of God is Within You, was not the confession story whereby Tolstoy explained how he came to his nonviolent conviction, but it's rather an advocacy text in which Tolstoy covers contemporary history and political thought and everything else to advocate his understanding of the moral rightness of nonviolence as a Christian position. Jesus is appealed to as a critic of Western established Christendom in such a way as to reject conformity and regular values and project a radically different moral world. Now, Gandhi attended Christian worship services a lot while he was in South Africa, but he never thought of himself as joining a Christian church, never thought of himself as Christian in that sense. A large part of his reason was that the Christians were so different from Jesus. But he did get from Tolstoy a vision of how different Jesus is from Western establishment, and the rightness of that position that Jesus represents. And the rightness of that position doesn't have to be dependent on your being in a Christian church, especially if the Christian churches don't hold to Jesus' position, as most of them didn't on the fundamental matters of the morality of power and segregation that Gandhi was already clear on. So what he got from Tolstoy was simply encouragement to believe that there is a fulcrum, a point of leverage, a place where you can stand outside the moral system of establishment and critique it and undercut it and work against it, that can have its own moral dignity over against the established moral consensus of the world of power. The other reading, of which he also says that when he read that book he didn't sleep all night, and which he set himself to translating into the Indian languages, is one that very few of us pay any attention to. How many recognize the name of John Ruskin? Almost unanimous. Two hands over there. Three. John Ruskin was, first of all, an art historian and an architect. He traveled around the world and wrote the beautiful descriptions of the buildings he saw. But he was also a kind of philosopher. And in that period, say 1860s, economics was not yet a statistical science. It was rather a branch of ethics or moral philosophy. So Ruskin also, as a person of very broad culture, wrote articles about the morality of economics. And one of his books was called Unto This Last. Now that's a Bible quote. How many can think of what passage it comes from? Again, almost unanimity. There's a parable in Matthew 20 about people working in a vineyard. Some of them worked all day, some of them worked 11 hours, some of them worked 9 hours, some of them 6 hours, some of them 3 hours, some of them 1 hour. And when the day's work was over, the owner of the vineyard paid them all the same. And then there was a debate with the ones who'd worked all day about whether they shouldn't get more. And the master of the vineyard, who in some sense represents God's position, says that because of my goodness, I'm going to pay this last one just as much as all the other. And Ruskin develops out of that a philosophical argument that everybody ought to have the same day's wage. That economic recompense for effort should not be based on status or technical expertise or seniority or whether my services are rare or not, the marketplace, but should be based on my family's need for a living wage. So that the wage system should not be a basis of discrimination, but of equalization. From that, Gandhi came up with the idea that there should be an economic base to the search for a new community, not simply fighting against discrimination on the basis of race or some other kind of discrimination, but there should be an affirmation of a wholesome, egalitarian economic system, not one without personal efforts and rewards or without personal property, but one in which there would be a basic equalizing thrust in the way the structures of society ought to be set up. So he went from there to set up the communal farm, first of all in South Africa, and then later the ashram in India, which was at the same time an economic production unit, a farm, and a school, and a retreat center, and a mission base for his ongoing activity. Now, we have pictures in the movie of the ashram life, but never long enough to understand how basic it was, because we really only see that when people come from the big city or when the events of global politics impinge on the place where Gandhi was living with his people. And then the film leaps 15 years and they give you another date and the story starts again. But what were they doing during those years? Well, they were just sitting there in their farm, retreat center, school, mission base, editorial office, developing movement. So there is an economic equalizing vision which comes from the West, from the moral idealism of the Anglo-Saxon 19th century, John Ruskin, and still illuminates something about what it takes to have an economic base, a social power base, also a psychic base for a resistance movement within India. Well, Gandhi himself says those are the things that turned him around. Tolstoy's book, Ruskin's book, in addition to his first dramatic experience on the train station platform at Pietermaritzburg. Now, of course, what we know from this end is that he developed strategies or techniques, tactics of nonviolent direct action. The march, the fast, the sit-in. So we have to turn to what makes those things make sense. Seen superficially, nonviolent action is a better way to carry on a conflict. You can obtain political ends with less bloodshed, although not without bloodshed, if you develop appropriate nonviolent tactics. That's so true, or at least it's so possible to argue that, that the first extended attention that was given to Gandhi in the West was by people who weren't interested in the philosophical and religious base of Gandhi's movement, but who just saw here is a promising new tactic. So a man named Richard Gregg published in the early 1930s a book called War Without Violence, meaning if there is a cause for the sake of which in other times and places people would have fought a war, now we can tell you how you can serve that cause and win what you have a right to without physical violence, without bloodshed. It's a better technique. And that's often the case. That can be argued for certain kinds of conflicts in certain situations. But that isn't the point for Gandhi's movement. Gandhi didn't start by saying it's a better tactic, although he did develop tactics. For him, its rootage in a religious worldview was always part of the picture. And that was a Hindu worldview with significant Christian input. First of all, on the formal level, the very first general strike wasn't called a general strike. It was a fast. It happened to be a day that Hindus weren't supposed to be out on the streets anyway. And it was a normal pattern of Hindu devotional exercise to both to fast and to stay home from work in the marketplace. He proclaimed it, Hartal was the word, and the news got around and just nobody showed up that day. So it had the effect of a general strike, but it was at the same time rooted in something that was deep in the Hindu culture. Processions likewise. And even the notion of refraining from violence, we say in English non-violence, and then we have the problem of defining what is violence so that we know what the negation of violence is. There's a similar linguistic problem in the other languages, but the term was already there as if it were a positive term, the renunciation of violence, ahimsa. Himsa means harm, and non-harm was an old religious moral term. He didn't make it up, and it didn't sound like an abstraction, as it does initially in English. The renunciation of doing harm is itself a positive commitment. It isn't just that there's something that you could do that's bad and you decide not to do it, but the withdrawing, the withholding the potential for harm is itself a positive Hindu spiritual discipline. Now, for you to use those methods of renouncing violence, you have to have beliefs about the world that make it sensible to renounce violence. And this is why my title is The Power of Truth. Gandhi's autobiography, he didn't actually write a sustained story of his whole life, but he did put together pieces describing kind of the first half of his life. is called The Story of My Experiments with Truth. Truth is a power out there. It works. It is at work. And what we do is learn by experimentation, that is, by trial and error, and sometimes by success, well, collaboration with the way things are, we learn to let truth have its way. The purpose of a nonviolent action is not to coerce people in the sense that it breaks their will or hurts them, like a boycott by taking away their income, but it's to get their attention so that they can see the truth of the situation, and especially see the fact that they are oppressors and that they are doing evil. The function of our getting in their way, of our not cooperating with them, of our standing in front of them even at the risk of their doing something to us, and in some cases, of course, there were massacres or there were confrontations in which the nonviolent activists were wounded. We do that so that it may become visible to others, to the public, to the government, to the media, but also to the instigator of this evil system, how evil what they're doing is. It's a call to conversion. To do that, you have to believe somehow that there is spiritual power. It's not just a matter of manipulating this kind of coercion against that kind of coercion. This fits for Gandhi with the very long historical patience of the Hindu worldview as over against the Christian components and the Western components of his style. Hinduism is the oldest religious system, and it hasn't changed much for 3,000, 4,000 years. It's inclusive. It can absorb whatever comes along. It can afford to be patient. The belief in incarnation means that there's always another time to try, and if it doesn't work this time, there will always be more. So there is a sense of patience that is part of the fundamental cosmology of Hindus looking at their world. So we can wait. Truth can outlast error. And if we die this time, the dance goes on. The process of truth having its way doesn't depend on my victory. It's already decided because it's truth. And what depends on me is just how much I contribute to truth having its way by being at those places and opening the channels so that my neighbor can see through me the truth of his being an oppressor and maybe respond to that truth by changing. So there's a religious worldview. I said first there are religious procedures, and the last point is the one I referred to on the way. The ashram is a religious community discipline base. It's a place where one cultivates a different view of the world, where people learn to see the world that way, not just by taking a few lessons or capturing a few ideas, but actually by having their lifestyle coordinated around that. There's some people think that Holden teaches people a different view of things, partly through the way it's structured. Think what it would be if you stayed here for 6 months. The film doesn't say much about the living disciplines or the prayer disciplines. Once in a while there's reference to prayer, but it's usually when Gandhi's going to go to his prayers or when he and his co-workers were just praying and Ali Jinnah, the Muslim leader, comes along and tells them, we've got to get down to work now. And so the prayer is around is shown in the film, but not what it means to be a praying community. And yet Gandhi's community had a discipline of prayer, morning, noon, and evening, not very different from a Western Christian monastery, which was a large part of its community power. It was a base for publication. It was a base for a worldwide network of correspondence. He was writing 50, 60 letters a day, they said. This was before the days of the typewriter, so he had several secretaries busy. All of this based in a community, which was tied together by religious observance. And since Hinduism is a very tolerant religion, the worship was not only Hindu worship in the old modes, it included Christian hymns and Muslim prayers and other elements, Buddhist prayer disciplines. It was authentically inclusive. And that religious base was, in Gandhi's own mind, what it would take to win. He actually thought that his ability to achieve something on the political level would depend on the quality and the intensity and the purity of his own prayer discipline, and not on the number of disciples he had out somewhere sending money in or carrying on direct actions. Another element that isn't in the film very strongly and is less directly religious but belongs in the report is what he called a cultural program. That is, there was a clearly defined alternative vision for what an India ought to look like that wouldn't be the India of the British Empire. He wanted this culture to be based in the village and not in cities. He didn't, in principle, like cities. He didn't like a high level of technology. He was in favor of the sewing machine because that could be done in the home. But he didn't like big mechanized looms. You see him with a spinning wheel in the film, but it doesn't explain how important is the spinning wheel. It was actually the symbol of his political party, the Congress Party, because it represented a host of things in his cultural program. The spinning wheel means that woman's work is not less important than man's work. So what women used to do, Gandhi does. And every member of the Congress Party has to spin some every day or weave some of the homespun cloth. And until just the last few years, it was still a part of the party discipline to have to wear khadi, the homespun, home-woven cloth, that affirms the dignity of manual labor. It undercuts the exploitation whereby India had to send its cotton to Britain to be spun and woven and then sent back and bought at a much higher price. It's a testimony against urbanization. It's a testimony in favor of even the intellectual working. A whole set of meanings cluster around this little portable spinning wheel. In fact, it was a Polish Jew who developed a portable spinning wheel. So he wasn't against modernization if it made something basically simpler and more usable, but he was against urbanization as the answer to the world's problems and against industrialization as an answer to the world's problems. So that there needed to be a positive cultural alternative. It wasn't just modern India is fine, we just want to take it away from the British. But modern civilization, modern Western civilization is not attractive. It gets worse rather than better with its increasing technological power. That doesn't mean, however, that he's simply a traditional Indian in his cultural vision, and that shows the most clearly in his rejection of the caste system, which is deeply rooted in the Hindu worldview that he was basically affirmative about, but that one thing he categorically rejected. He said when he was adult, he'd even rejected it when he was a child. And at this point, he hit his own Hindu fellows head on with the same methods that he used against the British. So his movement was not a nationalistic movement in a simple sense. He could be against the Brahmins, against the people who used their old-fashioned kind of power in their traditional culture in an oppressive way. And he contributed to the considerable degree to which caste has been relativized in Indian politics, although it still hasn't been overcome in the whole culture. And maybe one of the stories from the conflict with the Hindus ought to be told because it isn't in the book, it isn't in the film. There was a temple which was frequented only by the upper castes, maybe even only by the top caste, the Brahmins. And its sanctity was such that even the road in front of it was taboo for lower caste people. Happened that that road was the only good way to get from one place to another. If you didn't take that road, you had to go far around. So it was an enormous inconvenience for all of the other people not to be able to use this road. And Gandhi was called on. He was in that neighborhood for other reasons. He was called on to see if there was any way to permit that road to be usable for ordinary traffic. They weren't trying to get in the temple, but they just wanted to be able to travel up and down that road. And the Brahmin said no. So he arranged for a vigil. People of the lower castes would just stand there. They wouldn't fight. They wouldn't run down the road and make the cops stop them. They just stood there. And then it flooded, and they stood in the water. It got too deep to stand in the water, so they sat in boats. It took most of a year, but finally the Brahmins came and pleaded with these people, please use the road, we can't stand to see you standing there. It was an authentic conversion. There was no power. And that didn't get in the press in England to any substantial degree. In any way, the Brahmins in that neighborhood in India didn't care about the British press. It didn't twist the arms of anybody back in London, but it twisted the spirits, or it straightened out the spirits of people who finally saw the power of the caste system hurting people, and they changed it. So that's one of the specimens of his using his power against a flaw within his own culture with the same kind of thoroughness and the same conviction that it is the truth that will turn people around, not our power. Now, Gandhi was not absolutely nonviolent in a theoretical sense. In this sense, he wouldn't have been quite with Tolstoy. He supported Britain in four wars, not with military service. He didn't believe in his using violence, but he thought that his people properly should give a kind of moral support to the British cause rather than the other cause, because it was through the maintenance of the British system that there would be some chance for progress. One of these was a so-called Zulu War in the 1890s, where the colonial presence in South Africa was threatened for the last time by a black uprising. Then the Boer War, in which the Dutch reform population of South Africa defended itself against the liberalization of the British Empire, then the First World War, and then the Second World War. All four times, he supported Britain in a nonviolent sense, that is, not with military service, but he recruited people sometimes for ambulance service, or in other ways took sides. And since that looks like inconsistency to some people and not to others, it's worth looking at a minute. Part of the reason is that the decision to reject violence has to be a free decision. So if anybody else wants to defend himself with violence, I don't have a right to keep him from doing that, because I would be imposing my position on him. So if the majority of people want to have a draft, want to have compulsory military training, I won't train to kill, but I have to grant that they have the right to do that, and similarly with the war itself, because the decision to renounce violence has to be free. It can't be imposed on people. Secondly, a very pragmatic consideration, the British system is a more likely basis for our ongoing liberation struggle. If India had been integrated in a permanent Japanese empire, it would have been worse for the Indians. Or if in the South African case, the Boers had become independent of the British, it would have been worse for the Indian minority in South Africa. That's a pragmatic political consideration, but it's also one that counted. The third is a little harder to translate. Courage is better than cowardice. To be authentically nonviolent is the truest courage. but to renounce violence when you aren't authentically, courageously nonviolent, maybe cowardly. And that's worse. Now, this is not Hindu culture. This is Western culture. This is one of the places where he's adopted a Western sense of dignity and personality. To renounce violence is really only meaningful. It's really only a spiritual decision if you are powerful, if you have the possibility to use violence and then don't. That's a meaningful, courageous moral decision. But if you're weak and you have no other weapon than the weapons of non-cooperation and violence and suffering, that's not necessarily a high moral position. Renunciation must be an act of strength and not a weakness. So none of those considerations changed his insistence that violence is never intrinsically right and is never his way, but it did lead him to be qualified in applying that standard to nations, to the British Empire, in the major political conflicts of the 60 years during which he was thinking about politics. The last kind of point I want to make before opening it up for conversation, because I trust that we have plenty of background to take the conversation farther, is to try to describe the way in which he puts together what we take apart, or rather he refuses to see as separate what we have been taught to see as separate. It isn't that he puts them together, he thinks they should never have been apart. Religion and strategy, or the moral imperative level and the practical tactics level. A way to be like God and a way to move history. We have generally learned to separate those two levels for the sake of clarity about each of them. We respect both, but we keep them separate, or at least we think of their separateness as a part of our trying to get our heads straight. So we can say, do you renounce violence because God says it's wrong, or because it's counter to the nature of God or the words of Jesus, like Tolstoy? Or do you renounce violence because you can get farther without it? Because it happens that if you engage the conflict on the level of violence, somebody else is stronger than you are. And if you use nonviolent tactics, you're stronger than they are. Is it religion or is it tactics? And Tolstoy was the clearest person to say that we don't even think about tactics. We just take the straight moral imperative, and that's all we ought to think about. Gandhi doesn't pull them apart and choose one that way. It's all the same. At the same time, it is right because it's right, because it's like God or like the nature of the universe, and it's effective. And we can show you how it's effective because we can do the social studies of how it is that it works. We can do the psychology of how it affects people's consciences. We can do the statistics of what a work stoppage does to the economy. The religious meaning and the tactical meaning are not separate. It's all one reality, one discipline. And we'll see it again from another perspective tomorrow evening in talking about Martin Luther King, but it starts here. We could even say that the fundamental intellectual originality of Gandhi, over against Tolstoy, and over against Western pragmatic political thought, is his not being able to see those two worlds separate. It's right because it's like God, it's like truth. It's also right because if you plan properly and play by the rules, it'll work. And those two are not to be separated. And since they aren't to be separated, you never have to ask which is the important reason. They're both important reasons. And you don't have the kinds of choices that we have very often in Western moral discussion about the morality of the absolute religious imperative as over against the morality of effectiveness. It's both. Maybe we can talk again tomorrow about more about why he thinks that holds together. But for now, that should be enough to lay the religious or religious intellectual backgrounds of what Gandhi did before us. And you, most of you have in your own memories the story itself that's in the film, and some of you have other perspectives. There's also good literature on the book table upstairs. So you take it from here. We have another quarter of an hour anyway. Yeah. Good religion is good tactics. Good tactics is good religion. The way we have... It works because it's right. It's right because it works. And those are not contradictory. Or we would say in the West, it's right, but it won't work. Or we would say it works, but it's not right. But if you have a different religious perspective, those two aren't that distinguishable. And that's true, that's the case, because the universe is basically coherent or true. That is, there's a lot of evil in the universe, but it's somehow in its place, and ultimately it will come out. Hindu polytheism, Hindu reincarnation, there are various aspects that are in the very long range affirmative about the world, and in the short range not as uptight as we Westerners are of trying to save every situation by getting rid of every evil the day after tomorrow. It occurs to me that for the sake of the tape, I should maybe be answering, playing back the questions, which we don't normally have to do in the other building. The question is pushing further what I said about the right and the working. Is it always both, or is it one or the other? We may come at it seeing only one or the other. That is, there may be situations in which you don't know enough about the structures of things and the responses of people to know what'll work, but you just know what's right or wrong. There may be other situations where you see so clearly the mechanics that you know what's how it's going to work for the welfare of people, but you don't know of any moral theories that apply. So there might be times when you would think of only the right-wrong question or only the working question. But in the reality of a religious world vision, they still belong together, even if you don't think about them both. But I didn't mean to limit us to that last philosophical question by ending there. Anything else along the way, or anything from your memory of the film, would also be appropriate to bring in here.
Not germane to what you've said so far, what was the position of the man who was assassinated?
What was the position or the motivation of the man who assassinated Gandhi? Well, he was part of a movement. In the film, actually, there was an old guru with a especially long, dirty beard who gave him signals at the major types when he did something. Also, earlier in the story, that was a very extreme Hindu tendency that saw his undercutting the caste system and his wanting peace with the Muslims as betrayal of the basic Hindu interests. And those are two points at which he was critical of Hindu culture. Tension between Hindu and Muslim was centuries old, and that was also a result of a kind of colonialism. The Muslims were in the minority, but they had been the empire that took over India once. So the Hindu majority felt toward the Muslims about like black South Africans feel toward whites, except that then the British came in and had another level of imperial power. But that deep tension between the religions and the races had been there for a long time. It hadn't been able to boil over since the British Empire had begun, but it was always there. So Hindu-Muslim antagonism and the Hindu caste system, and then other minor elements of just the notion of modernization at all, or making any kind of peace with the British were also offensive. But it was the two former that were really the what Gandhi did that was offensive. Or popcorn or something. Yeah. Does anybody else remember what Gandhi said? The American reporter asked him, would your tactics work in Europe? I don't remember specifically that episode from the film. What he tended to say to that kind of challenge was a very modest affirmation that in principle they would have to, but he's not close enough to know just how, and he couldn't promise they'd work fast. There's a very delicate challenge involved in understanding what he said to the Jews, and he was sufficiently aware of the Jewish situation under Hitler. He told them at the same time that they shouldn't use violence, they weren't doing anyway, most of them, but that they should resist, and they weren't resisting in the way he would have. As the Jewish social structure collaborated with the Nazis to send people off, and that is, they were not globally resisting Hitler. Now, of course, one could say, well, if they had, it would have been even worse. Well, but it would have been different. And it's an argument you can't carry out in a credible scenario. But he was aware of it, and he saw that as a special challenge. He didn't try to duck it, and he didn't promise that it would work well. Because he knew, I just said that with regard to the Japanese, he knew that the British are better people to run a liberation movement against than some other people would be. And he was realistic about that kind of calculation. So against the Nazis, he wouldn't have promised early success, but neither would he have said, therefore, it would be it's the right thing to do to have another world war. That's an insightful question, and there are several different levels on the answer. When Gandhi said that the only authentic renunciation of power, of violent power, is the person who would have it and then renounces it, what does that do about the people who actually don't? I think there's several different levels on which his position would respond, although I can't reach back and get a quote on each of them. One level would be that by developing new patterns of resistance, he shows people who didn't know they had power that they do have power. That is, garbage collectors can tie up a city in 2 weeks by not collecting the garbage. They're very unimportant people unless they don't work. But there are certain places in society where a work stoppage by people way at the bottom is very powerful. That's kind of a parable of the one kind of thing that people who, one by one, or as a category, don't seem to be powerful, can, with the proper mobilization, really be somebody and have a sense of dignity and capacity to contribute to changing things. So that's one level. If you get the right tactics, you find out that people have power who didn't know they did or didn't see themselves as disposing of power. Another level, he would actually say, it's not the best. But people who have no other weapons, non-cooperation as a weapon, it doesn't have the same dignity of people who would have had weapons. But I'm still showing these people they can do something. So he often said that Muslims who have a vision of righteous violence and a tradition of being fighters and then don't fight are morally superior to my Hindu people who were patient and had no tradition of fighting, and now just turn the patience against the British. He had a friend who was a Muslim leader in northern India, and these were really kind of bandit tribes who had noble tradition of righteous violence, but turned it around and actually imposed, through the leadership of his friend, a discipline of nonviolence. And Gandhi said, their nonviolence is morally more powerful than ours, because they're renouncing something that was actually strong and psychically strong in order to use nonviolent tactics, whereas all of my poor, untouchable people, they're using the only power they have. They didn't have guns, and they didn't have a militant tradition to renounce. So that didn't mean that if people had no other weapons, they wouldn't use it, but that he was convinced that the most authentic moral decision was that of people who could fight back violently and chose not to, because they were really choosing among options. Well, I think I want to make both points. One is that when they have no violent option because they have no guns and somebody else does have guns, they can still discover a dignity and a power that they had by finding nonviolent tactics. But the second point that I made with regard to the Muslim group is the more basic one, that you would have guns, or you would have a cultural tradition of massacring people back when they massacre you, and now you don't do it. That is a more important moral commitment than if you never had such a tradition. And he said both. I mean, he made an affirmation on both levels.
I think that a very good, very contemporary example of nonviolence is the mothers of the Thursday's afternoon in the Plaza de Mayo in Buenos Aires. They are the most responsible group for toppling the military from power in Argentina. And they did nothing else than to put a white scarf on their head and go there with a picture of their disappeared sons or husbands or grandchildren. I think that nonviolence works well when you use something that the system can't do anything against.
Again, for the sake of the tape, my own reaching beyond Gandhi to modern cases will come later in the week, but I think it is a very excellent specimen. The most effective political protest against the military dictatorship of Argentina in the past 10 years now has been a crowd of women once a week meeting in the main square of Buenos Aires outside the government palace and just standing there with the pictures of their sons or nephews or husbands who had disappeared, or now in Spanish, who had been disappeared. To disappear is now becoming an active verb in the jargon, that is, who had, either by the government itself or by some allied rightist death squad, been eliminated or taken somewhere into prison. And that presence did nothing week by week, but in the long range it did more than anything else to undermine morally the viability of the Argentine dictatorship, so that once it did its stupid thing about the Falklands, Malvinas, it was already morally hollow, because this presence of women once a week had undermined it. There was a woman at the World Council of Churches meeting who had been one of the mobilizers of a similar kind of protest in Peru when their husbands were fired by a tin mine And again, it was the women who carried on a nonviolent protest movement. So the space for finding a particular way to say something is one of the elements that we have to talk about more. Gandhi found the right gesture. And this isn't just a matter of political science. It's also a matter of artistic skill. Which gesture is going to fit? Some gestures work, some gestures don't work. To have a mother with a white sash or white scarf holding her son's picture, that's such an obvious symbol of what's wrong that it works. Other times it wouldn't work. Sitting in a drugstore or Woolworth lunch counter in North Carolina was just the right thing to do about segregation in the American South in public facilities. Sitting in sometimes wasn't the right thing to do. There were other sit-ins that weren't effective. So there is an element of artistic or aesthetic fittingness, psychological shrewdness, timing, shape, that just finds the chink in the situation where you can make a point that they can't get back at. And that element of skill or charisma in finding the particular gesture is a part of the picture that makes the difference between leadership genius and other people trying to use the same tactics for some other purpose. And that's the point at which Gandhi was more than just somebody with a religious theory. He just happened to think of the right time. And if you read his story, it was usually a surprise. He hadn't thought ahead. Most of the new things he did, the first fast, the first strike, it just came to him in a flash like that. There was the long-range discipline of maintaining a movement and circulating his journal. But the particular gestures that turned out to be effective, the particular movements and tactics, came with a stroke of inspiration. There wasn't quite as much of that in King, but there was some of that there too. So that what Gandhi would think his life proves is the power of truth. That is, if you line yourself up with an ongoing community discipline, with the nature of the cosmos, it has to work out for peacemaking. Well, I'm sorry, our time is up. We should let the people in quick. Thanks. Yeah, that's right. Well, there was also something in Peru, but those tin mines were Bolivian. Thanks.